Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, Cape Town's port turnaround faces its biggest test yet as billions in fruit exports go on the line. The Transport Minister is standing by to talk to me. Tax-free transfers between spouses could be under threat with potentially costly consequences for couples. South Africa's only dedicated whistleblower support organization says it may be forced to shut its doors. And can an employer reject a traditional healer's sick note, or does the law require greater cultural accommodation? It's Wednesday, the 12th of August. Now, billions of rand in fruit exports are riding on whether the Port of Cape Town can deliver a reliable export season. Transnet says vessel delays are down, equipment is improving, and contingency plans are stronger. But last season's disruptions cost fruit exporters heavily and forced significant volumes through to other ports. So my question, has the problem genuinely been fixed? South Africa's Minister of Transport, Barbara Creasy, is on the line. Minister, a very warm welcome. After billions of rands in losses last season, can you assure fruit exporters that Cape Town is not going to fail them again this season? Let's be honest, last year was a mess.
Jeremy, last year was a grave disappointment to all of us because we had spent about 2 billion rand on new equipment for the Port of Cape Town. We were very confident because in previous years, equipment breakdown had caused problems with the season. But between November and December last year, we had 32 days of wind speeds over 100 kilometers an hour, which basically means that every second day we were unable to load fruit. And that is an enormous challenge for the deciduous fruit industry and the table grape industry, because you would understand that most of those producers are targeting tables in Northern Europe in the Christmas week. So unlike the citrus season, for example, which is more diffuse, this is a very intensive season, and there's really no room for delays and for errors. What I can share with you is that yesterday was a very good meeting that we had with producers and also with agents. And let me speak, first of all, what we are doing from our side, and then I'll talk about how the broader ecosystem wants to function to get better outputs in this season. So from the side of Transnet, we've analyzed what went wrong last year. The key issue is, when the wind stops, can you get all hands on deck immediately? Because you may only have 5 or 6 hours in which to load up a ship before the wind starts again. And what we found was that we didn't have sufficient labor available in the docks. And this year we have reorganized the leave schedule so that those stevedores that are working in the Western Cape don't take leave during the intensive season. But what we are also doing is we are bringing in stevedores from Durban and also from the port of Gqeberha, so that when the wind stops, we can operate every berth in the dock. And we can obviously then, regardless of the order in which the ships might have come in one by one, we can then work on all of them at once and recover much more quickly. We are also improving the trains that come from our back of port facility, Belcon. So what we do when there's wind is we bring the containers to Belcon and to other private back of port facilities where we plug them in. What we want to do with the Belcon facility that is very large is last year there were only one or two trains that were operating. Now what we want to be able to do is to operate five trains at a time. A train can carry up to 100 containers, so it's obviously much more efficient than having 100 trucks coming into the into the docks. Right. So this is how we are working. But what was very interesting about yesterday, because I went into yesterday expecting a severe beating, and what was interesting was the agents were saying, look, Transnet has improved. What we now need to do is we now need to set up a port community of practice, so that we have control and oversight over the entire value chain. So we don't just want to have Transnet and producers. We need to have agents who are responsible for transportation and back of port storage and relationship with farmers. But we also need the shipping lines there, so that when there is a problem, we can work together. How are we going to solve the problem, right, and all the ducks will be in a row?
Minister, let me put this to you. Cape Town was ranked last out of 400 container ports in the last World Bank Performance Index. You've listed a lot of improvements, but are they genuinely transformational, or are you simply recovering from an exceptionally poor base?
Look, we, and I mean, this was said to me in the meeting yesterday, that the low base was 2023. 24-25, we did better. I think the issue in 25 was that we didn't do as well as we thought we would do because of the exceptional wind. But as far as I'm concerned, climate change is a fact of life. So we have to accept that we are likely to have severe wind. And we can't be using that as an excuse for not performing. What we have to do is to develop our operating systems to such a point that we can operate even if there is extreme wind. And when that wind dies, we must be ready to roll, and it must not take us 3 days to get our act together.
Minister, 9 of Cape Town's 11 terminals, as I understand it, are already privately operated. If the container terminal continues to underperform, are you prepared to bring significantly greater private sector participation into that operation as well? That would seem to me to be the current trajectory.
Well, that was the argument I was expecting was going to be put to me yesterday.
And it wasn't.
What interested me was that what they were saying to me is, not everything is within Transnet's purview. And in modern ports, they have this community of port system. In a lot of modern ports, this is an IT system backed up by AI. It reflects for all players the whole value chain. And if you want to improve once your equipment and your labor are functioning, then you've got to be looking at the whole value chain from the producer to the ship. And they were saying to us, your war rooms are fine, but your war rooms are focused on Transnet itself. Now we need to be putting up a war room that is dealing with the whole value chain. And everybody in that value chain has to be accountable. We hear that Transnet is being more transparent, more accountable, more responsive. But the agents need to be more, and the shipping lines themselves. Obviously, that's complicated, Jeremy, because the agents are competing with each other and the shipping lines are competing with each other. So there's all kinds of information they don't want to put into the public domain. But what we are working on during August and September is what information do we need in order that the value chain functions effectively. And how will everybody who is normally competing with each other cooperate on this baseline information so that we get better productivity? Of course, in the long term, we want to put in an IT system to handle this. But while we are developing that system, we've got to be using human beings.
Barbara Creasy is South Africa's Minister of Transport. Thank you very much indeed. Building wealth doesn't happen by chance. It happens by making the right decisions. Join John Manike from Old Mutual at the MoneyWeb Economy and Investing Conference at the Money Summit as he shares practical strategies for building long-term wealth, avoiding common investment mistakes, and creating lasting financial success in the real world. Tuesday, the 1st of September at the Sandton Convention Center. Register for free using the promo code MoneyWeb. Secure your seat today. Go to moneyweb.co.za and start building a stronger financial future.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, I read that a long-standing tax exemption for transfers between spouses could soon be restricted, but only where the spouse receiving the assets is no longer a South African tax resident. Now, let me try and explain. National Treasury says some couples are exploiting the exemption by transferring substantial wealth to a non-resident spouse before the second partner emigrates. That would sharply reduce the capital gains exit tax. So let's explain to you who's exposed and whether maybe Treasury has gone a little too far in this respect. I'm going to talk to tax attorney at the Leap Group, Reinert van Rensburg. A very warm welcome to you. So in your analysis, is Treasury closing a genuine tax avoidance loophole, or some are suggesting maybe penalizing people simply because their spouse lives abroad?
Yes, Jeremy. So firstly, thanks for having me. So Treasury did make it clear that they want to introduce this change specifically for wealthy taxpayers who are exploiting a loophole whereby a resident spouse is donating assets to a non-resident spouse simply to avoid the exit tax. But in reality, within the Income Tax Act, there's already a rule applied to those type of donations. So when a resident spouse donates assets to a non-resident spouse, it already triggers a capital gains tax at that point because the rollover relief does not apply to that transaction, whereby a resident spouse donates to a resident spouse, the recipient spouse moves into the shoes of the donating spouse with the same base cost, same market value of the same asset. But that changes when a resident spouse donates to a non-resident spouse, there's no rollover relief available. So the resident spouse is deemed of disposing those assets into the open market. So that triggers a capital gains tax in itself.
So what kind of tax then could a resident spouse face when transferring assets to that non-resident partner?
So firstly, it will trigger that CGT, as we mentioned, but with the new law amendment, they want to apply donations tax to that same transaction as well. So it will essentially result in a compounding tax being levied. A lot of people are referring to it as a double tax, but at the end of the day, it's two different types of taxes being levied. So it's just a compounding tax resulting in a higher tax burden. And I did give it quite thought why Treasury want to introduce this change. And what makes the most legal sense to me is maybe regarding the estate duty base in South Africa, because as soon as assets leave the South African tax net into the hands of a non-resident, and that non-resident passes away, the estate duty is not levied on most of those assets. So it might have something to do with estate duty itself, because that's the main purpose of the nation's tax, is to avoid a situation where an individual transfers their wealth just before they pass away, just to avoid estate duty. And that's why donations tax are there, to be applied before you pass away and to avoid the estate duty itself.
How common is this practice of transfer then? I'm assuming the Treasury wouldn't be moving on this unless there was a trend here.
Yeah, so we have seen it on numerous occasions in practice. But in my case, I advise my clients to simply remain subject to the Section 9H deemed disposal, because Section 9HB also triggers the exact same taxes on that transaction if you donate to a non-resident spouse. So whether you donate the assets to a non-resident spouse or keep it in your own name, when seizing tax residency, both those types of transactions will result in the same deemed disposal being triggered essentially if we take a look at the correct wording within the Income Tax Act.
Are there legitimate transfers that could be caught in this net? I'm thinking of things like family support or maybe even the movement of assets that have been jointly accumulated.
Yes, there can be. So the tax law change is focusing and targeting wealthy taxpayers avoiding a loophole. But at the end of the day, it will also apply to ordinary South Africans having to transfer assets to family, spouses abroad while they're non-resident for a specific purpose. So it can have a negative impact on those ordinary South Africans, even though they are targeting wealthy taxpayers who are trying to close off a loophole.
Does SARS not, though, already have sufficient anti-avoidance powers to challenge an artificial arrangement without changing the exemption for everyone?
Yes, absolutely. So, as mentioned, the Section 9HB is one of those anti-avoidance rules that can be applied to make sure that the extra tax is not avoided. And that specific section, I believe, was already introduced in 2019. So when a resident spouse donates the assets to a non-resident spouse, the extra tax is triggered in any case. And that's the type of anti-avoidance rule already being applied. So it's very interesting to see them trying to introduce a donations tax change on the same transaction, which actually covers a different type of purpose relating to estate duty.
Is there the risk that a couple could face tax in the country where the non-resident spouse lives? And if I'm following my own thread here, that surely could create a double tax problem.
So not really a double tax problem, because if we take a look at donations tax specifically, it's always levied to the donor. So it's subject to the donor's residency status, where the donor is considered ordinary resident, and the funds being received on the other side in the non-resident country, but it's all subject to the country where the person is residing as well. But in a general sense transaction, there won't be any necessarily any tax consequences on the non-resident side simply receiving a donation from an individual in another country.
If I understand this correctly, the draft was published months after the proposed effective date. Correct me if I'm wrong. If that's the case, though, is it legally and ethically acceptable to impose a tax retrospectively?
Yes, so they did introduce the possible amendment or comment on it in the budget speech in February already. So now this draft bill was introduced months later, actually providing the exact wording that will be enacted. And they want to apply it retrospectively from February already. So any transactions happen in the meantime, that donations tax will apply to those transactions as well. So it's difficult to comment on fairness itself, because on the one side, Treasury needs to protect the South African tax base, but they also need to ensure certainty to taxpayers as well. So there's certainly a raise of concern when it comes to fairness and legal certainty, but then again, Treasury needs to make sure that they prevent a situation where taxpayers run to ensure they take certain transactions just before legislation is enacted. And that's why these type of policy changes are introduced quite suddenly.
And just a final one, should affected couples then, give us some advice here, should they pause transfers immediately or do they need to get some kind of professional advice before acting in any way?
Based on the current wording of the proposed amendment, I would say the resident spouses need to avoid donating assets to non-resident spouses, because you don't want to be subject to that unnecessary donations tax if this is passed into or enacted into legislation. So I would definitely say avoiding that transfer itself, because as mentioned, that transfer does trigger its own capital gains tax. So there's no real difference between donating your assets to a non-resident spouse to avoid extra tax in comparison to keeping it in your name and just go through with the extra tax itself. It has the same effect from a tax perspective, essentially.
From the advisory group, the LEAP group, Reinert van Rensburg, tax attorney, thank you very much indeed for the explanation. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa keeps saying whistleblowers are essential to fighting corruption, but an organization set up specifically to support them now says it could be forced to close. Since 2022, if I'm not mistaken, the Whistleblower House has received something in the region of 515 applications, has supported over 300 qualifying whistleblowers, and currently has 47 active legal cases, but also says donor funding is running out. This comes just months after government published a new protected disclosures bill promising stronger legal, financial and security protection for whistleblowers. This is a very important issue within the current South African paradigm. The Chief Executive Officer of the Whistleblower House, Ben Natron, a very warm welcome to you. Let me ask you this. If South Africa's only dedicated whistleblower support organization can't survive, what does it seriously say about the country and our ability to take whistleblowers seriously?
Well, the only thing we can think of, and after months of begging, we don't believe the country takes whistleblowing seriously. I don't think companies realize the value, and government themselves, we are very concerned about how much they care about whistleblowers and, more importantly, about fighting corruption.
Why do you think we're not taking this seriously enough?
Whistleblowers are invisible until somebody gets murdered. If you think about carefully, whistleblowers is not... They don't make headlines every day. They do make headlines when it's too late. And we have been knocking on doors, government, private sector, businesses, small business, corporates. And unfortunately, they have other priorities. And when we look at the South African environment, the priorities would typically be food, health, food, education, gender-based violence, and then children, taking care of children. Whistleblowers do not feature very high on any agenda at the moment.
How close then are you to actually shutting your doors, and how much money, Ben, do you need to prevent that?
Okay, the reason for the publication that we're running out of money is that we have 3 months operational budget left. 3 months, August, September, and October. If that money runs out, we have no money. We've already informed, and I've got to give credit to our service providers, the lawyers and the psychologists. We've given them notice in May already that we don't have money, so they must either go very slow with cases, or if it can't be helped, if a case is enrolled in court, please proceed. But bear in mind that that is at risk because we don't have money. And the difficulty you have in normal business terms, if your credit is higher than what your balance and your actual cash flow is, you are in trouble because then you've got to declare bankruptcy. We have been notified yesterday that we've got a small grant, which we didn't expect, it's out of the blue. And the next two donors are sitting, one in September and one in October. And if that money does not come through, we are forced to close the doors in this year still.
Have you gone directly to government for financial support? And if so, what response have you received?
We've been in discussion with government on the CARA funds, the Criminal Asset Recovery Account. And we do have a MOU with the SIU, where if they have a whistleblower, they actually have asked us to help. In May month, in June, we had told them we can't take all their whistleblowers anymore because we don't have funds. We have written to the police minister asking, can we access CARA funds? We are waiting for an appointment. And that would take a bit of time, but that is the solution, because if you think about the new legislation, it will not come to fruition for at least 36 months. So there's a gap of 36 months as we're sitting here today.
Ben, there is, of course, the question about whether government should actually be funding you. And let me explain. How can one take state money while remaining independent enough to support someone exposing corruption inside that same state?
Let's not just state to the state. Let's assume companies, and we can list any company, it's a neutral conversation, Telkom, Eskom, if they give us money, that does not stop us from supporting the whistleblowers out of Eskom and Telkom. We do not look at the company who funds us, and then we pick sides on that one. We provide service to the individual whistleblower who desperately needs it. You asked me a question about funding, and this before the time run out. Any individual person can donate. We've got a donate button on our website, thewhistleblowerhouse.org. We are hoping corporates and businesses would come on board where 100,000 or 1 million rand can be donated at one stage. And that is, you asked me what my burn rate is. Anything between 800 and 1.2 million a month, based on where we are with the legal system.
I assume that you're having some very awkward conversations with those people involved in the 47 active legal matters right now. What are you telling them and what is their response?
They're very disappointed. They're in various levels in the legal system. And what we've spoken to both our clients, the whistleblower, and the service providers. And the service providers have agreed we're absolutely critical. They will continue with the services and at pro bono. And if money becomes available, we'll then talk about, do we have enough money to actually pay them? We cannot afford to recruit new service providers or add workload because that would be irresponsible.
Ben, as far as I understand it, government's new Protected Disclosures Bill promises confidentiality, access to legal aid, and even witness protection in serious cases. If those protections work, why should an organization like yours still be necessary?
That's 3 years down the line. Let me just put that out there immediately, because if the bill gets tabled today, it will take 18 months to get through the system. Then they've got to write regulations to go with that. They've got to allocate and appoint people. Nothing will happen before 36 months from today. Only then do they start operating. They've got to build up their systems, etc. If that system is alive and well and it works properly, potentially the whistleblowers can close the doors. I'll be happy to do that. The chances of that happening, because the reason why NGOs exist is because government cannot perform the duties expected of them.
Ben Taron, thank you very much indeed. You are the Chief Executive Officer of the Whistleblower House.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, can an employer reject a sick note issued by a traditional healer? The law may allow a company to refuse it as proof for paid sick leave, but dismissing the underlying cultural belief, I think, could still lead to an unfair labor decision. The issue has been sharpened by the incapacity tribunal involving Judge Lepono Lekale, where medical evidence and traditional beliefs point in a very different direction. It really is a big South African issue. I want to talk to Jonathan Goldberg now, who is chairman of Global Business Solutions. Such an interesting issue, Jonathan. Welcome to the program. Can an employer legally reject then a traditional healer sick note?
Hi, Jeremy, and to you. Hello to your listeners. So there are two things we got to just understand. One is payment for the sick note. So the payment for the sick note is really regulated by the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, or by any agreement you might have, collective agreement that you might have with your employees. So let's take the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. At the moment, it only recognizes medical practitioners. So the issue around traditional healers' notes, and again, it's diviners, herbalists, and traditional birth attendants and traditional healers, is regulated by the published Traditional Healers Practitioners Act, which was published in 2024. But that has not been affected yet. So there's an intention to include these traditional healers based on registration, a whole lot of compliance. But that's not gone through yet, and mainly because there have been objections from traditional healers about this act. So that's still in debate. So currently, only medical practitioners that are registered and accredited, that includes some nurses that have additional qualifications, they can issue these notes, and these notes then be paid by the employer.
It does, though, create a tricky situation, difficult for an employer then to avoid unfairly discriminating against an employee's cultural beliefs.
So there are two issues. So that's in respect of payment, whether you have to pay. But the Kibbutz-Kruin matter, a labor court matter, really emphasized the issue around a cook who wanted to take some time off to go to his traditional healer and to go through that picket exercise, where the employer could have given him the time off but refused. That time would have been no work, no pay generally. So it's a different issue as to whether you need to accommodate a person's traditional beliefs or a person's traditional note. Whether you have to pay for it, of course, is the question regulated currently by the BCA, Basic Conditions Employment Act, which of course will change when the Traditional Healers Health Practitioners Act comes out. But currently, you would still have to consider whether Johnny or Jeremy could take the time off and go through a traditional healer program, as an example, to heal me if I believe that was going to heal me, and give me the time off. That's an incapacity decision. Can the employer allow Johnny to go off without any particular pay for that period of 2 months to go through that particular program? That's the issue. And the Kibbutz-Kruin matter says, well, you've got to recognize my beliefs, and if you can, get a temp in or other people can cope, then you should allow me the time off because I'll come back. I'll come back a better person, healed, and be able to continue to cook in your establishment.
Am I correct in thinking that you've also identified the bigger problem, not traditional healing, but more the state's failure to establish a functioning practitioner register?
The state's tried, Jeremy, but of course, you know, again, practitioners have to be registered with the appropriate statutory body. And again, that requires the tax net and the registration net, et cetera, and of course, some people don't want to participate in that particular structure. So there are some objections to the way the current Traditional Health Practitioners Act has been positioned. But the point is, it has to come out. It will come out. And I think these people that are registered and accredited by a professional body will then be able to issue these notes in terms of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act.
But there's a conundrum, because until that register exists, it's going to be difficult, Jonathan, for an employer then to establish whether the healer is genuine, qualified, or, as I think you're intimating, even identifiable.
And then effectively, from a payment perspective, you don't have to pay, but you still have to consider whether I could take the time off and your establishment could accommodate me. Now, remember, in South African labor law, many, many companies have recognized traditional healers. So they're part of the 30 or 36 days in a three-year cycle, and they acknowledge these particular traditional healers notes by a collective agreement. But the law is still catching up with that. And again, I think for the law to compel employers to pay, there has to be some type of accreditation, some type of registration. And of course, for all of us South Africans, some recognition that these are accredited businesses that are paying their taxes, as an example.
So as we have this discussion now with things fairly opaque, where does an employer draw the line between respectful accommodation and an absence that the business can no longer sustain?
I think it's a real factual question based on the job. And I think I always say that in terms of South African law, correctly so, the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, we have to give a female employee who has a child, of course, the Van Wyk Constitutional Court judgment affects that too, but we have to give 4 months off. So generally, the tolerance for me is always around about 4 months, because no matter what the position is, the person who gives birth can get 4 months off. So we tolerate that in terms of the law. So I would imagine that most organizations have the request would have to have some type of tolerance around 3 to 4 months before they could say, we can't tolerate this anymore, we can't keep you employed. That would be my guideline. Again, I've already alluded to the payment situation, and that's from organization to organization as to whether you want to extend your payment beyond the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. But I think we've got to have a bit more tolerance in respect of people who have the belief that they need to go through a program to heal them, as an example. And if that's a couple of months, I think most organizations can tolerate that.
So if that's the case, then what should every employer now put into a sick leave and incapacity policy to, Jonathan, avoid any kind of discrimination and abuse?
I think the fact that requests for time off will be considered based on the operational requirements of the business. And I think, yeah, you've got to have an open mind in respect of looking at the request and looking at the operational requirements and trying to accommodate the person. Because people have beliefs, like I have the belief that a specialist might cure me. Other people have different beliefs. Mm. And those beliefs, as we've seen in medical science, are very important in respect of healing a particular person. Your beliefs are very important in respect of your recovery.
Jonathan Goldberg, thank you very much indeed. You're the chairman of Global Business Solutions. And that's where we are going to leave it for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb. Your trusted source for business and investment insights.